night was still young over Santa Monica's Civic Auditorium. A big night for the movie capital in nearby Hollywood. It was Oscar night.
I'm sure that the nominees will be very grateful if I get this over with quickly. So, for the best performance by an actor supporting role, the nominees are Ed Begley in Sweet Bird of Youth.
For an actor or actress, the most desired symbol of all is still the Oscar. It alone can refuel the celestial fires. Among the hopefuls in the audience was an oldster, an actor who had brought another fine performance to the screen in a picture about youth.
And Terrence Stamp and Billy Budd, and may I have the envelope? And the winner is Ed Begley in Sweet Bird of Youth.
Ed Begley had his Oscar. WTIC dedicates this tribute to him. Bruce Kern now narrates that story.
He had made it. He'd come a long way, this man. He's the sort of fellow everyone remembers. Remembers his face, his mannerisms, his easy tread. They've never really changed, not for a moment. Actress Edith Baggish remembers him from the beginning.
Ed is, oh, golly, he's so many people. He's warm, and he's humorous, and he has great humility. He still has. And most of his humor is directed against himself, I must say. And the talk is always, how are you, and how are the children? And then, how is the gang in Hartford? And then he talked about himself. And this is the way Ed has been all through the years.
Broadway, radio, television, pictures. The long trek of a man who could always remember where he came from. And where he came from was Hartford. He was born Edward James Begley. His father was Michael Joseph. His mother, Hannah Clifford. From them he learned first-person history about show folk. And from them he acquired an ambition. To be an actor. The blood that runs through the man is a strong stuff, daubed with the rich, full life of Irish lineage. His mother and father were a part of that great Irish immigration at the turn of the century. Back in Killorglin, County Kerry, they too were gifted with a sense of showmanship, of theater. Ed's Uncle Martin, brother to his father, was a successful step dancer, amateur boxer, and even a member of the heralded Royal Irish Constabulary. Michael himself was a splendid storyteller and step dancer. Mother was attentive, loving. Once she screeched an early halt to this show-crazed youngster. Ed's brother Martin recalls the episode.
Ed was about 14, and he started entering Charlie Chaplin contests and winning most of them. Along about that time, he got a job as a helper on the delivery wagons of G. Fox and Company, and was eligible to go to the employee's annual outing. It was at one of those picnics that he won the Chaplin contest, and a man who was involved with a new film company, which had started down around Wethersfield Avenue, saw Ed perform and wanted him to work in the motion picture they were shooting at the time. But the brakes were against poor Ed. My mother wouldn't think of letting him do it, so whammo, that stopped his career right there.
With Brother Martin at his side, the two boys found a yeasting of the theater character that would prove to be their life's image.
I can remember when we were kids living on Goodwin Street, and on the corner was the Highland Court Hotel. An actor by the name of Edmund Elton, who was the matinee idol at the Polite Stock Company at that time, lived in the hotel, and Ed got to know the time of his coming and going right down to the exact minute. Well, Ed conceived a plan whereby he and I would get our big break to break into show business. At that time, I was able to do a few cartwheels and walk on my hands for about 3 or 4 steps. So Ed figured that if Mr. Elton saw such sensational acrobatics, he would rush up to us, sign me to a contract, and there's where Ed would step in as my manager. I was all of 7 years old at the time, and Ed was about 9 and a half. But either Mr. Elton was not a good talent scout, or else he knew nothing about acrobatics. He not only didn't sign us, he didn't even look twice at my tricks.
That aura of an earlier Hartford lingers in Ed's memory. Home was the long since gone East Side, Avon and Windsor Streets, where the Irish-Italian influence kept life from being anything but dull. He had a kind of boyhood he could, well, look back on with pleasure. A boy's life that was pure fudge. Bit parts in Hartford's stage theaters won him respect as a capable performer. And Ed would always play his part, no matter what, to the hilt. Ed's formal education ended in grammar school. And when you don't study, you work. Ed worked as a theater usher, soda clerk, short order cook, for the street department, and at the wire mold company. His boss was D. Hayes Murphy, now chairman of the board of directors.
My first impression of Ed Begley was of a lad coming up to me in the shop one day and trying to sell me some tickets for the Hartford Players. I was in Winnetka, Illinois, when the family listened to the distribution of the Academy Awards. And naturally, I was thrilled when his name was pulled out of the envelope. And there was one fella in Winnetka, and that was Hayes Murphy, who understood what he meant when he said, "I've come a long way from Hartford." He sure has.
Times changed, and Ed was growing up. Radio came into its own as a whole new stage of entertainment, and Begley went knocking on doors. One of the doors he knocked on was Paul Morenci's, president of WTIC.
Everybody that ever knew Ed liked him. He is an effervescent type, you know, friendly, big voice, happy. Most of the time. Of course, we all know he had his personal problems. And actually, a great deal of the respect and admiration which he now commands is due to the fact that he overcame these personal problems and, in spite of them, has risen to the top of his profession.
Ed's enormous versatility as an actor proved a delight to the Guy Hedlund Company. He was as genuine as an Irish father as he was in the spurs and hat of a Western sheriff. From the Guy Hedlund production of The Man Who Could Fly, this was Ed as Uncle Dan.
Oh, for one of those hours of gladness gone, the last I got used to soon. Dan, where are you, old Dan Kinneen?
Quiet, girl. I'm here in the study.
Oh, I've come over to see the sick lad you brought home from India.
Well, sure, now that's real neighborly of you, lass. But I think you'd better wait a while. There's a great doctor in there examining my nephew now.
Oh, is he worse?
No, indeed, he's better.
Then why the doctor?
Well, it's a special doctor, a great psychiatrist.
Oh.
The one we had before was just a common weekday kind of a doctor, you understand. And Tommy puzzled him entirely with his queer raving and ranting when he was sick. So he said we'd better have Dr. Morley over from London.
You mean something has turned his brain?
Well, I don't know, Kathleen. I'm waiting now to hear.
Oh, and he's such a fine, handsome young man.
Yes, it'll be a poor thing indeed if he's lost his wits. I'm half distracted about it all.
Well, then perhaps I'd better be calling another day.
Oh, no, don't hurry away, lass. Go out in the garden and see my verbenas. I still have them in the hotbeds.
What? They're still under glass?
Yes. For I'm afraid that when night is down, the cold mist will choke the poor things.
Oh, I love your fine big garden, Dan. Sure, that's what I'll do now. I'll visit the verbenas and come back later.
Yes, come back later, Kathleen.
His maturity and toughness provided just the right touch as the lone lawman of the West, the town sheriff. The part he played in the Hedlund production of Two Saints on the Foothills.
Here I am, Joe.
Where? Oh, yeah, yeah.
Say, how many of you are there here?
Well, I'm just one man, Joe.
Buddy, I see three of you.
You been drinking again.
That ain't all I've been doing. I've been seeing ghosts, too.
Ghosts?
I'm not fooling, Sheriff. I just passed the graveyard and got so excited I threw it up in a bottle.
Well, what'd you see, Joe?
The ghosts of Daddy and Mammy Downing, and they was digging.
Are you sure of that?
As sure as I'm sure that I ain't sober.
Well, what were they digging?
I didn't wait to find out. What's wrong? Don't you believe in ghosts?
I certainly do. Come on.
Where to?
To the graveyard. Follow me. Well, look there. This grave. Somebody dug it up. And that coffin has been pried open.
Huh?
This is Mammy's grave. And look. Her body isn't there.
Somebody stole Mammy.
Why, there's nothing there but just papers. Why, look at these, will you? Papers from those safes that were robbed the other night. Joe, we've been fooled, all of us.
Fooled? How?
Mammy was never in this coffin. She never even died.
Oh, she must have, Sheriff. I helped bury her myself.
What we buried was all the money that had been stolen. Joe, you round up the boys. If we find them two saints, we'll hang them.
Now he had his trademark, the menace, the heavy. But he continued to be uniquely versatile. George Beau directed Ed in many performances.
He had more vocal expression than anyone I had ever heard. He could do more with his voice. He's just a natural. We had a series during the early days of the war called The Road to Victory, and Begley played in practically all of these, and it was just wonderful to have him, because if the leading part was a Nazi, Begley was a Nazi. If the leading part was an American soldier, a rookie in the ranks, Begley was it. We had one where we had to have the voice of the American flag, and Begley was it. And believe me, you got the feeling with him doing it that the flag could actually talk. He's just magnificent. What a great guy to work with.
Writers remember him, too. Irwin Cowper called him a natural.
Ed Begley was what we called in the trade a natural. He could pick up a script cold and read it right off without a fluff, just as though he'd lived with it for a week. You can't be jealous of the success of a fellow like that. You just admire him tremendously, and we all do.
And Ralph Klein penned dozens of the Headland plays.
I don't think the public realizes what a fine comedian Ed Begley is, that he's got a terrific sense of timing for comedy roles, and there isn't a part that he couldn't portray.
...1942... war is news, and Ed decides to brave the fathoms of New York. Now he has to cope with the inner ordeals of a man who does what he has to do because his code requires it. At an early audition, the director tells him, "Begley, you're doing all right in Hartford. Why don't you go back there and be happy?" Unnerved, Ed took the audition. Afterward, the woman director apologized. She had just witnessed a Begley performance.
1942, I finally decided that it was now or never. So I went down to New York in September 1942. Everybody thought I had a contract in New York at the time. They said, he wouldn't give up, a sure thing and go down there. But I didn't. I was auditioning down there. Paul Lucas had given me a letter. Mr. Morenci had given me a letter. And through these people, I did get auditions down there. And then I went right on from there and became probably the busiest radio actor in New York.
On radio, the Begley voice booms from home speakers coast to coast. From sympathetic roles as Homer Brown's father on The Aldrich Family, to tough, swashbuckling ones on Counter Spy, Charlie Chan, the FBI man. In each, he gives the typical Begley performance. Broadway successes are slow in coming, but they arrive. With never a break in stride, Ed could go from roles in Land of Fame and Getaway Old Man to All My Sons. Through them all, He never changes. Edith Baggish.
Ed talks about himself to this day as a workhorse. This is the way he describes himself. He says, I'm just a plodding workhorse. Well, he's not a plotter, that's for sure. He's a worker. He wanted very much to act, and he was able to do so many different kinds of parts.
Later in the play, Inherit the Wind, the story of the famed Tennessee court battle on the teaching of evolution, Ed is cast as orator William Jennings Bryan, and Paul Muni as his arch-rival Clarence Darrow. Suddenly, Muni is forced to leave the cast. The producer asks Begley to switch to the Darrow part, his adversary, a whole new character, and Begley agrees to do it. His performance even surprised the critics. Later, Paul Muni remarked, "I wouldn't have attempted this even if I were given an interest in every theater on Broadway." For his role, Ed receives the Theater Critics Award. Edith Baggish recalls the moment.
When he was doing Inherit the Wind with Paul Muni, he won the Drama Critics Award. I teased him. I said, "Well, how about that big shot? You got the Drama Critics Award." And his answer is something that I think she'll always remember. He said, "Edie, working with Paul Muni is like a marriage, like a very good marriage. He gives so much. He works on such a high level that you've got to stay up there to keep up with him."
Not all his plays were received so warmly.
I did a play which was put on at the Belasco Theater, written by Albert Bine, who had written two pretty good successes. But this one that I was in was not one of his better plays. I played a Nazi general, and George Jean Nathan gave me a review which I have never forgotten and hope never to forget, because if there's any danger of me ever getting a swelled head, all I have to do is think of this review in which he said, "The man who played the Nazi general looked like a fat Jimmy Durante."
Now that Ed had mastered the labyrinthian avenues of New York theater, it was inevitable that the Begley character should move on. There was only one direction to go, west.
I had been saying no to all movie offers because I didn't like the idea of going to Hollywood. I didn't like what I heard about the caste system out there. And, of course, it was all wrong. And when I got out there, I found that it wasn't anything like I had heard.
In its golden age, in the first years of the movie boom, the mood and manner of Hollywood were indeed much like that of a gold rush. There was the frenzy and buccaneering hurly-burly of an earlier California, when the vast fortunes found in a day were squandered in a night. The same cheerful violence and cutthroat anarchy. All of that turbulence has been silenced now. The wild and woolly charm is just a memory. The feverish gaiety of the great dream factory is gone. A certain brassy vitality drained away. Another industry is building quite another town. And already, rising out of the gaudy ruins of Screenland, we behold a new, drab, curiously solemn brand of the old foolishness. The strong national flavor of television has replaced the old international flavor of pictures. Ed Begley was caught up in that new brand called TV, and his old familiar countenance and gruff, heavy voice began portraying the usual villain, bootlegger, sidekick, father, gang boss. Each was a performance in the Begley tradition. He simply became the character, as Eunice Greenwood, who played opposite Ed many years, recalls.
I remember a recording he did. He actually was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It wasn't an imitation of FDR. It was FDR himself. I don't know how he did it. We never could figure out how Ed did these characterizations.
The television credits spurred out from Hollywood. Route 66, Dr. Kildare, Ben Casey, Empire, The Dick Powell Show. Ed never ran away from a part. He stood and faced his faith, sometimes alone, overcoming whatever was missing and doing the job. Floyd Patti was a member of the Headland Company and often stood across the mic from Ed.
I knew he had a lot of ability. He'd slide into a part just about as easily as any actor I've ever seen. He could immediately grasp a part. He almost knew instinctively what the characterization would be. To Ed, it was just immediately living that part. He was a very sincere actor. He never put on any flourishes or anything phony. He immediately became that part, no matter how insignificant. He didn't care. It was a complete script of two lines. Ed was in there. He's pitching. He gave his all, and he was a darn good actor. But I thought he was too easygoing to really make it. He had the sort of problems which would have floored 999 actors out of 1,000. And that is the reason that I would take off my hat or salute him on bended knee for making what he has made now. To make what he's done is tremendous.
Ed Begley means something. He stands for something. His is the inner ordeal of a man who does what he has to do because the Begley Code requires it. His guiding light in Hollywood is his agent, George Morris. Unflinching in his confidence of Ed, Morris has piloted the image well, offering advice, getting him good parts. Now the Hollywood that may have been blurred by fantasy and falsehood has been swept away, and a Begley performance is desirable and in demand. Appearing in over 21 pictures, the Begley trademark was seen in Patterns, Rod Serling's television classic in which Ed played originally. In a revival of What Price Glory, John Loves Mary, 12 Angry Men, Odds Against Tomorrow. Each done with the same conviction, the same lust for character, that is Ed Begley. Ed was appearing in Advise and Consent when agent George Morris learned that the Tennessee Williams play Sweet Bird of Youth was about to follow the path to the screen at MGM. Ed, he said, if they ever make the film, which they're going to do, you must play Boss Finley. The Begley touch of simple honesty and unpretentious warmth follows him wherever he goes. Find the Begley dressing room, and it'll be a gathering spot for not only the other stars in the picture, but the lowliest crew member on the set. Ed shares a common bondage with the simple folk because he loves the real simplicities he grew up with.
Ed today is as he was then. Perhaps the only differences are a maturity which comes to all of us, we hope. A solidity which comes with knowing that you have arrived in your chosen field. More self-assurance, which happens with time and experience and the kind of exposure that he's had and the success, of course. But his basic character, the man who was Ed Begley, is still the man who is Ed Begley.
Here's a man whose education lingered a while, to be denied until there was time to read and find oneself. Yet, somehow, Ed never needed teaching. He somehow knew. He still considers himself a small-town boy at odds with the big city, always happy to come back to his hometown where he could pass as just another old-timer. Betty Patti remembers how he once just dropped in.
I can remember one day after Ed was famous, and we were living in Newington. We were doing a radio show, and one morning, he and his family just dropped in and spent the day. He was in from Hollywood, and I think this is a very clear picture of the man. He hadn't gotten so big that old friends didn't matter, and we were not at the stage where we corresponded or anything like that, but he was in town, and down he came, and he stayed for the day, and we had a fine time. Now, very few people, after they get to the top, do this sort of thing. When they're in town, they hit all the spots where it's going to favor their publicity and so forth. And not that I blame him, I would do exactly the same thing. But this man was a very lovable character.
Leonard Patricelli used to write and direct Ed, grew fond of him, and is still his close friend. The two of them used to love to attend the fights together when Hartford could boast of world-leading boxers from Kid Kaplan to Willie Pep.
I was in the office one Tuesday afternoon late when I received a call from New York. Ed Begley speaking, said he, in that deep bass voice of his. "You going to the fights tonight?" I says, "I certainly am. Willie Pep is fighting." "I'll be there," he says. "I'll see you at the gate." At 8 o'clock on the dot, up drove a big, black, shiny Cadillac with a chauffeur. Seated beside the chauffeur was Ed Begley. I walked up to the car. I said, "Did you hire the Cadillac in Hartford?" He says, "No, that's my Cadillac. That's my chauffeur. We drove from New York." He dismissed the chauffeur in the car. We went into the fights and saw a great fight. After the fight, the Cadillac was there waiting for him, and I said, "Where are you staying tonight? What hotel are you staying at?" And Ed said, "Pat, why don't you drive me to your place?" He said, "I'll send the chauffeur along." I says, "Fine. It'll be like the old days." He sent the chauffeur along. I said, "Well, what hotel are you staying at?" He says, "None." He said, "Drive me to the same place you drove me years ago." I said, "You mean off Capitol Avenue?" He said, "That's right." He said, "That's where I stay every time I come to Hartford." He says, "I've been paying rent on it ever since. I sleep in it probably once a year." I says, "But I don't get it. You've got all sorts of money now. You could afford the most expensive hotel." "I keep that cold water flat," he said, "just to remind me from whence I came."
At home in Merrick, Long Island, he resumes the role of an ordinary father, enjoying his two children, Aline, 14, and Eddie Jr., 13, offering the same attentiveness and parental love his mother, Hannah, and his father, Michael, gave him. And on Sundays and feast days, the family can be just another of the parish faithful, worshiping at the Cure of Ars Church. Ed Begley personifies an image, an actor's idea of the ideal actor, a man whose character and courage overcame personal handicaps and whose code has justified the long climb to the top.
And the winner is Ed Begley in
He has indeed come a long way since Hartford.
WTIC gratefully acknowledges the following people and organizations for their contribution to this Ed Begley tribute. To Harold Gilman, MGM Studios, Hollywood, Charles Bell, General Manager, WHAY New Britain, and the American Broadcasting Company. The Oscar and Ed Begley was written and produced by Paul Gianfrido, narrated by Bruce Kern. Technical supervision by Bill Lobb. Franz Laubert speaking. This program was produced as a special project by WTIC.